Coming up this week in computer hardware, Android OS update. The manufacturer might be lying. AMD's got Spectre 2 patches. We don't have a Ryzen 2000 release date yet. Icy Dock 16 Bay Beast. Wait a minute. Intel Kaby Lake G doesn't use Vega? We're going to talk about all that and more on the next episode of Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 461, recorded April 12th, 2018. Where is Ryzen 2000? Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch Weekly Show that aims to bring you the most useful, most engageable, most affordable, most delightful, and occasionally most profitable news about hardware, desktops, laptops, mobile consoles, the Internet of Stuff, I'll call it, since this is a family podcast. We are in all the way, ready to bring you the most practical and useful hardware news available on the planet. We do reviews, too. And you know who's here with us today? The man, the myth, the legend, Ryan Shrout has returned.
Do you think there are people who have subscribed to the show that didn't know I was supposed to be on it?
If they subscribed in the last 2 weeks, it is a possibility. There were good reasons, most of which you cannot discuss because of the fear of large, angry lawyer shark creatures on retainer at various large companies, so we won't get into that. I am going to ask you a question that I'm not sure you are actually allowed to answer at this point. Do we have a release date for the AMD Ryzen 2 processor yet?
I don't know if we do. I will say that they've said by the end of April. Like when they said April, they meant it. So it will be coming out in April. And I think sooner rather than later, you will know. I don't know what they've actually said publicly now that I think about it. But if you follow the patterns that they did with the first generation, they did a pre-order, then they shipped, you know, a week later or so. I would imagine they would follow the same cadence this time around. The 12th? So we've only got, 2 weeks left in April? So that's kind of our maximum window. It'll be soon. We've already saw, Amazon posted pricing information on their website accidentally for, you know, a couple of hours. And of course, the internet gobbled that up and posted it on Reddit and all those various locations. So like the pricing on there looks interesting. If that actually holds up, $329 for the top part could be compelling. But we'll have to see what that performance actually looks like and what the pricing actually is when all that hits. Probably, a week or two.
I mean, if you were speculating, do you see a significant performance boost? Do you expect a significant, am I going to be looking at my 1800X and being like, I got to buy another processor?
No, I don't think that's the case. And I don't think that's what AMD has ever proposed would be the case. That this is called Zen Plus for a reason. It's not Zen 2. It's the Ryzen 2000 series, which may and inevitably will cause confusion. But Zen Plus was always kind of, and I know that they have told me publicly that like they're looking to get somewhere 10%+ better than they were from similar level SKUs that they've had in the first generation, right? It's 12 nanometer, not 14 nanometer, but technically it's the same process node. It's the same foundry. Nothing really changes. There's some tweaks here and there. So no, I think if you have an 1800X, if you have a 1700, chances are this is not the upgrade path for you. What will be interesting is if you bought in at say, a 1400 or a 1600 part, right, with fewer cores and lower clock speeds, that maybe going into the higher core count, like the 8-core highest end Ryzen 2000 series part may be more compelling, right? It's going to be a fairly low cost upgrade in the grand scheme of things, especially if you look at the world of graphics cards today. And you may be going from 4 or 6 cores up to 8 cores at higher frequency. And that might be more interesting. But I think if you're an 1800X, if you're a 1700X, you're probably not going to be compelled to upgrade, would be my guess.
Well, we're talking about AMD. We recently talked a lot about sort of the Spectre 2 variants and how Intel was abandoning those updates for some of the older processors, either because they would be almost impossible to implement or they felt there was no point. But AMD rolled out the CPU firmware and Windows 10 patches to protect against Spectre exploits this week. And I thought this was interesting. One, because a lot of these are actually being rolled into the motherboard manufacturer, or have to be rolled into the BIOS by the motherboard manufacturer. And Brad Chakos over at PC World very specifically says, cross your fingers that your system will even see the motherboard updates needed to apply AMD's new CPU firmware. You don't download Spectre mitigations directly from Intel or AMD. You need to wait for the maker of your motherboard or pre-built desktop to release new BIOS with the fixes wrapped in. A quick check of a handful of prominent Ryzen X 370 motherboards didn't show any April BIOS updates. The Tech Report says it was able to fully patch one of its systems. Patience is key, it seems. So, you know, he goes on to speculate that Ryzen systems will probably see the update. Older systems probably won't. I'm kind of curious what motherboard manufacturers are currently working on. And I think you and I were talking offline about this or outside of the show at one point, where it's interesting to contemplate with a motherboard manufacturer has 34 different motherboards in a single chipset or small group of chipsets. They really have to prioritize, I think, where they apply their resources to keep all of them patched or updated. Yeah. I think about that a lot when I'm looking at some systems that are a couple of years old. But if you go to AMD's website, they've got the security updates. The Spectre mitigation update came out a couple days ago. And I also think it's kind of funny because some of the early responses was, Spectre meltdown, that's an Intel thing, not us. Microsoft is releasing an operating system update containing variant 2 Spectre mitigations for AMD users running Windows 10 today. Support for these mitigations for AMD processors and Windows Server 2016 is expected to be available following final validation and testing. In addition, microcode updates with our recommended mitigations addressing variant 2 Spectre have been released to our customers and ecosystem partners for AMD processors dating back to the first Bulldozer Core products introduced in 2011. And again, those are going to be based on BIOS updates. So, it's good that, I think the majority of stuff has been or will be patched shortly. I feel comfortable saying that.
One of the things that I feel like AMD left out of this discussion that I wish they would not have is the performance side, right? So, yes, right. AMD benefits because, Meltdown doesn't affect their architecture. AMD believes that Spectre variant 2 is a near zero threat to their architecture to be exploited on architecture. You know, these mitigations, microcode updates come down to making that non-zero, near zero to be actually zero. But, Intel went through the same stuff in terms of releasing microcode updates and stuff. And there was a lot of discussion about performance. And depending on where you looked and what benchmarks and what applications and workloads you were using, that ranged anywhere from 0% effect to, 25-35% in like storage heavy benchmark type applications, with real world being somewhere in the mid single digit performance deficit would be my guess.
Right.
AMD doesn't mention anything about performance and degradation in their update, nor do they mention a lack of performance degradation in their update, which leaves me a little bit concerned that there is something there to be seen.
We didn't mention it. Therefore, it's not going to be detected by end users. They won't notice. Ignore the man behind the curtain.
I just want somebody to say something, right? And I told AMD this when they contacted us about this news release. I was like, okay, I asked them that question. They said, no, we're still looking into all of that. I'm like, well, you can't really have just one side of this story anymore. It's kind of important that you have both portions of it. So we'll see what happens with that. Like you said, within modern Ryzen parts will probably see this in a 2-week time span or something, 2 weeks to a month. So if nothing else, we'll have the ability to figure it out ourselves, even without some kind of discussion from AMD. But it would be easier if they set the expectation levels for us.
Remember, if you don't want to deal with bias confirmation and fear, run the benchmark, then upgrade the BIOS, then run the benchmark again.
Yep.
Although you could argue any Windows-based mitigations of those flaws could have already impacted the performance of your system, which is an interesting thing to contemplate. Good article up on Hard OCP. Kyle put together Monday this week. Intel rumors, Kaby Lake X, Skylake X, and Cascade Lake, which pretty much comes down to what's coming, what's going, and what in the world is going on. You know, this is total rumors, or as Kyle puts it, this is firmly rooted in the guys talk. You hear things category, still interesting information to mull over. Kaby Lake X will go end of life late in 2018 with no refresh, basically because nobody seemed to be buying them. Other than diehard Intel enthusiasts that were upset about Ryzen performance. Skylake X CPU refreshes Q3, very late, early Q4 2018, from 6 to 18 cores. No architecture changes, moving from PTIM or polythermal interface material to STIM, solder thermal interface material, for its integrated heat spreader, possibly to increase performance or to just make it that much harder for people to crack the lids off and cool them directly. You know, it's also kind of wild. There's a TDP bump going on there too. And Supermicro pointed out their next generation Super O motherboard supports up to 300 watts TDP running the latest Intel Core X series processors to deliver the, quote, ultimate in extreme gaming performance. Which is nuts, right? Target bins pushing around 5 gigahertz on 12 and 14 core parts with an estimated TDP range of 270 watt to 300 watt on socket R. That's just nuts. Does that sound just out of control, 300 watts for a processor?
Yeah, so we had the discussion last night too, and I think it's probably accurate to say that they won't be making 300 watt TDP processors,
right?
But that for people who want to overclock and push these parts, they're designing boards that can support 300 watts. I think I'm trying to remember back to the Skylake X reviews that we did. I want to say we were seeing 225, 250 watts power draw on those processors when overclocked, which means you needed some extreme cooling, obviously, to go with that. So it doesn't shock me that they would be preparing you know, motherboards that can go a little bit higher than that just for that enthusiast crowd. Although it would shock me if Intel suddenly released like a 250 or 300 watt TDP processor itself. Now, that's one way to get a bunch of extra performance, or at least some extra performance, you know, get that last extra 500 megahertz of clock speed. It's going to take a little bit more power than any previous 500 megahertz block of frequency. But that would be surprising. You know, the Kaby Lake X stuff kind of being canceled doesn't surprise me. It was a product looking for a problem to solve that didn't really exist, right? Remember, even when it launched, we were kind of like, we don't really understand why you need this, because it didn't have the benefits of higher PCI Express connections. It really only was, did you want to have the X299 motherboards? Did you want to use one of those platforms with a higher frequency part as opposed to a higher core count part, in which case there was just not a lot of advantage to doing that. Was it the ultimate gaming part? Maybe. But I think regular Kaby Lake was at least neck and neck, if not maybe a little bit ahead in terms of just capability and overclocking headroom. So, but it is interesting to see these rumors, if they're true, that they would be returning to the soldered thermal interface, which was, you know, it's one of those complaints that doesn't seem very major, but enough enthusiasts complained for long enough, and it may actually be affecting change. So, you know, if Kyle's reporting is right, that it's 150 to 200 megahertz advantage by that change.
That's pretty huge.
Especially for these parts that are not budget cost conscious processors, right? These are these are going to be your enthusiast level systems. So I, you know, spend the extra $3 on or $1 on that thermal interface and make everybody happy. Just do it.
Just make it better. Just do it the right way. In the heartbreaking news from the Intel AMD Graphics Partnership Department, a small but important desk here at This Week in Computer Hardware, Ryan Shrout reports, is the GPU in Intel Kaby Lake G more Polaris than Vega? And this, to me, is a big deal because it's been amazing with the last round of mobile parts from NVIDIA, you know, the 1050, the 1060, the 1070, blah, blah, blah. The mobile versions of those parts have been basically in parity with the desktop parts, just about as fast, despite the fact that they're stuffed in laptops, which is something we've never really seen between desktop and mobile processors with the same number before. Like, they had the same number. They're just a lot slower when you put them in the portable box. And then, of course, you know, we get this crazy announcement. We talked about it a bunch around CES that Intel was releasing a part with Radeon RX Vega M graphics on board. And now PC World started nosing around, Gordon over at PC World started nosing around and suggesting there are hints that this is not so much Vega and very, very Polaris. What is up, dude?
So this basically stems from a couple of data points that people have been kind of discovering as they went. It was always a question when we kept hearing about this part that was going to exist, Kaby Lake G, what architecture was it going to be based on? Was it AMD's Polaris or was it Vega? And it came out with Vega branding. It had HBM2 memory, so we all kind of went with the assumption, not just the assumption, that what we were told was correct, that it was based on the Vega design. However, the data points that have come up recently, there was some reporting done at PC World and at Tom's Hardware that showed essentially the DirectX version supported by Kaby Lake G differs from the discrete Vega graphics chips and the Ryzen APU that uses a Vega graphics solution in it. And instead, its support mirrors that of the Polaris discrete cards, right? So it's DirectX 12.1 is supported in Vega. However, it doesn't appear that it's being supported in the Kaby Lake G. And then this data point at Tom's Hardware is actually looking at a Cysoft Sandra synthetic benchmark that sees acceleration when you can do FP16, half precision math, as opposed to full precision 32-bit math on it. If you can accelerate things by running double-packed math, which is a feature of Vega. Double-packed math, rapid-packed math, I guess, it just means you can put two 16-bit operations in a 32-bit, in a single 32-bit operation, you know, clock cycle pass, thus effectively kind of doubling your throughput. And if you look at that graph, you'll see that Vega 56 and Vega 64 see about 60-something percent performance improvements when you go from single to half float shaders. And also the Ryzen 5 2400G, which uses a Vega 11 in there, sees about a 61% performance improvement. However, the Polaris RX 470 at the bottom and the Kaby Lake G see no performance improvements, or at least Kaby Lake G sees the most minor performance improvements. So these two data points are leading people to the decision, the assumption now, it's actually a Polaris GPU with an HBM2 memory interface on it. Because if you remember, Polaris only ever shipped with GDDR5 memory interfaces. So a couple of things to take away from this. One, it does not change my opinion. It should not change anybody else's opinion about this as a product, in terms of how does it perform, where does it stand in terms of its price segmentation, the unique products that it creates, like the Dell XPS 15 or the Hades Canyon Nook. Those are still awesome products that have really impressive gaming performance delivered by this product. The other thing to keep in mind is that Intel and AMD have all along said this is a semi-custom part, and semi-custom parts, by definition, are customized to some degree. So, I think what should have happened with this launch is they should not have given it the Vega branding. They should have called it something new. You know, like if you look at PS4 or Xbox One X, you know, they're based on customized Polaris architectures, right? But they don't call them Polaris based, right? They don't even, you know, they don't go that far. You really have to get nitty gritty into what proximity to which architecture are they. And I think, you know, maybe if you're Intel, you didn't want to have that discussion. Maybe if you're Intel, You wanted it to be Vega because Vega was the newest best thing and you wanted your part to be associated with that. And if you're AMD, you also wanted that. You wanted Vega to be good enough that Intel wanted to use it. Like what a feather in the cap that would be. Intel is demanding our latest architecture. So, you know, if you launched a part that you then claimed was Polaris, it's, you know, all that's last generation. Oh, of course they're using the old stuff. AMD's using the new, better stuff for their own parts. I'm sure there was some debate about how that went through. I think, you know, people that want to say this is some big conspiracy and all this are missing the dynamics of inside giant corporations where marketing can win out over engineering. And this is one of the examples of how that takes place. Is it a Vega design? It doesn't seem like it. It's missing a couple of features like rapid pack math and probably rasterizing, bin rasterizers and stuff like that. But it does integrate HBM2, a much more efficient more thermally and electrically and power efficiency, power efficient memory interface. So it is better than Polaris in some ways. So I don't know. This was something that I read about for a couple of days. I had enough people send me emails and wanted my opinions on it and whether or not I was going to chastise AMD and Intel for doing this. And so I felt like to say something about it. It's just, yeah, they probably shouldn't have called it Vega. They probably should have called it with Radeon graphics technology instead of Radeon Vega M graphics, you know? And we would have had 10 minutes back of our life on this show, for example.
I just don't know where to go with that, Ryan, other than to say, let us move on. And another cheerful news, after testing 1,200 Android deployments for 2017, researchers find OEMs often don't install the security patches they claim to install. ZTE and TCL each omitted 4+. And this is an article in Wired reporting on the findings of some security researchers. People have occasionally called me a Apple fanboy, an iPhone fanboy, a delete expletive that can keep his delete expletive opinions about Android security to his delete expletive self. But the reality is, you know, essentially Steve Jobs / Apple, but mostly Steve Jobs, managed to negotiate the ability to directly update phones instead of putting it in the hands of the carriers. And Android, in order to secure more market share faster, decided to allow the carriers to, you know, it goes from, you know, Android goes from, you know, Google to the carrier, or I should say to the manufacturers, from the manufacturers who tweak it for their phones to the carriers, and the carriers who tweak it for whatever services or cruft they're trying to push to the end user. You've heard me talk about this. In a minor case, firmware, the ability to read a micro SD card on a Motorola phone had been fixed for an excess of 12 weeks before AT&T finally decided to release that to me, right, so I could actually use micro SD cards in my phone. So this has been a long-running issue: fragmentation across the operating systems, relatively new phones that do not have upgrades to new operating systems or security upgrades. This is pretty crazy. This is the Hack in the Box Security Conference up in Amsterdam. A couple of researchers from Security Research Labs, they did like 2 years reverse engineering, quote, hundreds of Android phones, operating system code, painstakingly checking if each device actually contained the security patches indicated in its settings. And they found what they call a patch gap, writes Andy Greenberg over at Wired.com. You know, a gap between patching claims and the actual patches installed on a device. It's small for some devices and pretty significant for others. This is particularly crazy, and in some cases, quote, these guys just changed the date without installing any patches, probably for marketing reasons. They just set the patch level to almost an arbitrary date, whatever looks best. They looked at stuff from Google, Samsung, Motorola, HTC. Lesser known but incredibly popular in the U.S. Would be ZTE. They do some very affordable phones that are very affordable, TCL, And what's crazy is, despite or outside of Google's flagships like the Pixel and Pixel 2, quote, even top-tier phone vendors sometimes claimed to have patches installed that they actually lacked. And then the farther down the price curve you go, the messier it gets. So this is bad. This is essentially they are lying about patches being installed in the Android operating system to either accidentally or intentionally give you a false sense of security. So this is frustrating. Really, really frustrating. I mean, not just because, you know, in no small part, right, because I'm in a room full of security researchers and pen testers, but or I should say at the moment I'm next to a room full of security researchers and pen testers, but because there have been some pretty serious flaws that have gone out. And quite frankly, corporations shouldn't lie about having applied security patches to an operating system when they haven't. That sucks. People's entire lives are accessible through their phones. So quit it. And, you know, I could say go buy an iPhone, but I'm sure we'll find out, you know, something just as nefarious coming from Apple next week. But that's just because I'm an optimist. In more cheerful news, to quickly change directions before this turns into a massive rant, ICDocs Tough Armor MB516SP-B. I have no justification for wanting this other than I just think having 16 SSDs stuffed into a tiny box just looks really awesome. This is crazy, right? And I've worked in field production and video, and I've worked in field production with photographers, and I've seen photographers basically running around with what I will affectionately call giant ass NASAs in the field. But this is, you know, this is like eight drives. I would say some of ICDocs' previous parts or products were stuffing eight drives in a single 5 1/4 inch bay. This is just, I think this is wonderful. I don't even want to look at the performance numbers because it's just the whole idea of stuffing that many drives into that small space and the potential performance just had me so happy. This is a pretty dense. If you go to page two, you see the PCBs that they had to put together to make all of this work. And this is pretty densely packed in terms of hardware. And I can see why you might want to put a giant fan on top of this. But, you know, Alan literally had 16 Kingston 1 terabyte drives stuffed into this. And, quote, since the MB516SB-B does nothing more than act as an electrical pass-through for the data lines passing through its backplane, there's not a lot to test here beyond confirming that all drives negotiate at full speed. So it's fast, I feel comfortable in saying. 6 gigabytes per second with 14 drives, it ports out to 428 megabytes per second. Quote, this is well above the next rung down of 3 gigabits per second in the case where SSDs were negotiating a lower speed. But let's try and get closer to full drive throughput using some better tools. And then, of course, Alan does what Alan does, which is to get, you know, all Alan on testing. so let's say you're paying like, you know, 300 times 16 equals, yeah, it's $4,800 conservatively pricing of SSD drives inside of that. The box itself, the MB998SP-B is $120. The 516SP-B is $340. So it's a little bit more expensive, but this is an incredibly dense device. You know, quote, Alan, I did not expect them to step this further, but they certainly surprised me. The change did require a taller dual bay 5 1/4 inch form factor and a transition to quad mini SDS HD ports, but those are welcome and necessary additions. If you're looking for a well-built 16 bay hot swap backplane and have a pair of 5 1/4 inch bays available to do so, the ICDocs offers an easy solution for this need. and he gave it an editor's choice because it's really a unique product. But I just got so excited seeing 16 drives stuffed in there and, you know, transferring a half a terabyte a second doesn't really bother me at all either.
Yeah.
Is this something you guys might be? Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I can see why that might be the case. It's a pretty attractive number to look at.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, are you guys thinking about using this to do your live 4K captures, or was this just when you're doing the video card testing, or did this just happen to get thrown over the side of the boat and went in for testing?
I think this is a project of interest, not a project of usefulness, even for us at this point. There's not a lot of places where you need that kind of bandwidth. I mean, you could claim you're using it for 4K video editing. You could claim you're using it for our direct video capture system, but you don't need nearly that much bandwidth to do that. But hey, crazy people do crazy things. But there are a lot of other use cases in VM and enterprise applications for something like this, for sure.
What's up with the Azul Byte 3?
This is a tiny PC, kind of like a Nook-ish type deal. This one's fanless, mini PC. I never heard of the brand before, but this is a relatively inexpensive, like $200 system. It is a quad-core Apollo Lake, a Celeron N3450 processor, 4 gigs of RAM. They sell it. It comes with the memory, even for that $200 price point. 4 gigs, there is an 8-gig model. It comes with 32 gigs of storage on board, and then you can add a 2.5-inch SSD or an M.2 SSD if you want. AHCI SATA, no NVMe support here. It's got Wi-Fi on it, Gigabit Ethernet, Bluetooth, USB ports, SD card slot, IR control if you want to go down that route as well. It also has Windows 10 on it too. So it's actually a pretty good deal, not only just a pretty good device. It's fairly basic looking. It's got a VGA port on the back, give you an idea of the type of person that they're targeting with this. But you could use this for any number of, low performance requirements, mm-hmm. PC that you need to get through with it. It's fairly easy to take apart. Like I said, it already has memory on it. So you can just turn it on and run if you don't need any additional storage. Although I'm guessing if you're running a Windows machine, you're going to want more than 32 gigs of storage in that. Performance wise, it's not fantastic, but it does okay. If you look at like Geekbench and Cinebench results, it is, if you compare it to, we've tested several other ECS Leva mini PCs in the past, and you get a little bit of a jump over the previous generation models that had like the Celeron N3350 and then the N3050, but you're nowhere near what you're getting out of a 15 watt laptop performance part, right? So right. if you kind of look at those scores there, you got to set your expectations, if you will. But it's not throwaway performance at the very least, but it is. I did get an editor's choice from Sebastian this review because a lot of it is build quality is high, reasonable CPU horsepower for less than $200 fanless mini PC. It's actually pretty impressive. And though ECS and Zotac have gotten a lot of attention in this type of market over the last several years, we had never heard of this company. They reached out to us, wanted to see if we wanted to do a review. And it was a pretty impressive device on a budget. So again, you've got to have a specific use case for it, but I think it's looks like a good device.
I got to say quad core for $200 is pretty good, because I've looked at a bunch of the ECS devices. And if you were looking for something to build to use, a Plex box or something like that, this looks like it might be a nice alternative for that one.
Yep.
So it's a good price on that. I like it. HomePods aren't flying off the shelves is the word from Bloomberg. I can't say I'm entirely shocked, because they're incredibly expensive and they don't offer a lot of services and they don't do multi-room and you can't rig them in stereo yet. But Apple launched them anyway. But, one of the interesting things about this article is it points out that 70% of the people-controlled speaker market, I think, right now belongs to Amazon, which makes sense since they kind of got there first and fastest. It looks like Apple's cut back on their orders for this. And I'm very curious to see what happens when they finally bring on the multi-room capability and the stereo capability, which I said this before, I cannot believe they launched without. It's tough because at this point I feel like, between Siri and the whole Apple Home system, there's a big game of catch up to be played by, yeah. by Apple. I also thought it was interesting when you take a look at that graph right there, that the big chunk, the near three quarters on the right, that's the 73% of the smart speaker market that Amazon owns, 14% Google Home, 10% Apple HomePod. So they did a huge amount of sales, right? I think this has just been out since January. That's practically instantaneously being up to 10% of the market. The Sonos one is a mere 2%. I would also be curious what the market looks like in terms of total sort of home wired or home speaker markets. If that would flip with 70% of the market belonging to Sonos or 25% or something, because a lot of Sonos owners just aren't interested in getting the same audio quality when they could just plug a $35 Anker Eufy Amazon Echo clone, or just plug an Amazon Echo into their home system, kind of stream stuff to it that way. But I'll be very curious to see where this goes, because there have been so many efforts to, as Bluetooth speakers became less and less profitable, more and more, even large companies like Samsung started doing home-based speaker systems. And I'll be curious. There's a lot of kind of critical features in that were just not there with the HomePod, and I'm curious if the sales are going to pick up once those are available. I'm also curious to see if Apple drops the price, but I'm not holding my breath on that one, given the amount of time they have invested in making that. Other news this week in the Internet of Stuff, Amazon's buying our, I should point out, regular sponsor, Ring Video Doorbell. Ryan has actually bought at least one Ring Video Doorbell out of his own pocket. Quote, Amazon plans to let Ring continue to run independently with its headquarters staying in Santa Monica. And my immediate response to reading that was I looked up at a friend of mine and said, oh, well, hopefully that means they're not going to Google the hardware. and I felt kind of bad because I didn't, I mean, Google as in search on a web page, but Google as in buy the company, not really. It just buy the company and then make life more complicated for the product and then develop competing products or develop products that don't play. I'm very, very curious to see if Amazon continues to be smart and remain kind of hands off and let Ring do their thing. Pretty big sale, like $1 billion, which I was impressed by. But I hope Amazon does a better job with their acquisition of the Internet of Stuff than I personally feel that Google has done. So I want to be don't Google the product. That's all I'm saying, Amazon.
Fair.
Oh my goodness. Eventually. This week's episode of Tech Thing is going to go live. We've had some crazy uploading issues, which actually I guess you guys were having over at PC Per also. But when it is, there'll be reviews. We finally got reviews of the new debut 2.0 speakers from ELAC, which I was pretty excited about. Some new products from CanJam, some headphone products. And Shannon went nuts looking at Anchor's latest, car recording camera, latest dash cam, and compared that to the Z Edge. So we got a bunch of fun stuff coming up in the show this week. Is there anything you can currently tease? Obviously, we're all waiting on pins and needles for the next generation Ryzen, which I should say the Zen Plus or Ryzen 2000, since I am very guilty of calling it Ryzen 2, which it is not by any definition.
It's, well, it may be considered Ryzen 2, but it's not Zen 2. Zen 2 is an architecture. It is very confusing. I'm not going to lie there. Let's see as he searches around. Oh, I've got a whole new family of NVIDIA GeForce graphics cards with a review going up next week.
Ooh.
No, that's not true. That's actually a lie. I won't be any good with NVIDIA graphics cards for a long time.
That was cool.
Right now I have some interesting battery tests running comparing the Qualcomm PCs against the XPS 13 with Core M, the Surface Pro with Core M, looking at some battery life examples and configurations for that might be interesting to talk about next week as well. And let's see. I will say I don't think we'll be able to talk about – I don't think we'll be talking about Ryzen 2000 series next week, though, if that's a bummer. I don't know if that's the case.
Well,
give away as little information as I can. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe. Maybe.
Just come back to twit.tv/twitch. That's twit.tv/TWIH next week. If you haven't already subscribed, all the information for that is on the websites. Or you can just tweet incessantly at Ryan Trout and at Patrick Dorton on the Twitters to ask, is it here yet? Is it here yet? Because we know you're just as excited as we are about the next generation Ryzen processors. You got a question, feel free to tweet it out to us if you're building a system or you're curious about some hardware stuff. To use highly technical terms. With that, you can find more of me at techthing.com or avxl.com. Mr. Ryan Shrout is available doing his thing at pcper.com. Some of the finest hardware reviews on the planet. And as always, we enjoy your listening and we appreciate you joining us each and every week. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.